picture this. You finally get the promotion.
Oh, it's a big one.
Right. You climb the ladder, you step onto the new floor, and you walk into the corner office.
And the view is definitely better from up there.
It is. You've got leverage. You know, you've got the authority to actually make things happen.
Yeah.
And you just assume your team is right there cheering you on.
Because you're finally the one calling the shots, right?
Exactly. But then you close the door.
And it gets quiet.
It is incredibly quiet.
Yeah.
Suddenly you realize the cheering has stopped. You aren't the star player anymore.
No, you're the one holding the weight now.
Right. This massive structural weight of everyone else's expectations.
Yeah.
And you can't just, you know, pass that weight off to your friends in the break room anymore.
It changes everything.
It really does. So today's deep dive comes from a fascinating source. It's the secret diary of an educational leader.
Yeah, the staff room diary.
Exactly. And this leader learned the hard way that almost everything we are taught about career advancement.
And charismatic leadership, especially.
Right, that it's all basically a myth.
It is a remarkable, deeply raw document. I mean, we are looking at notes from an assistant head teacher for teaching and learning in a SEND school.
And just for anyone listening who might not know, SEND stands for
Special Educational Needs and Disabilities.
Right.
And while, you know, the setting is a school, the mechanics of human behavior it exposes, they apply to absolutely anyone.
Oh, 100%.
If you're trying to navigate workplace culture, manage a team, or just frankly survive organizational chaos, this applies to you.
So our mission today is to extract the unvarnished truth from these notes.
The hard-earned lessons.
Yeah. We'll look at why you have to abandon the desire to be everyone's friend, why those corporate wellness initiatives are fundamentally broken.
Oh, don't even get me started on those.
I know, right? And we'll get into the danger of linking your identity to your job title.
It's a heavy one.
It is. So let's start right at the beginning of the diary, back in that quiet corner office.
The loneliness of leadership.
Exactly. The author highlights that transition from being a peer who can, you know, vent about a tough day to holding unshared responsibility.
You're just on an island.
Yeah. And the very first lesson they write down is that true leadership requires the demise of the charismatic hero.
The author lays out this core philosophy and it's so punchy. Clarity beats charisma.
Clarity beats charisma.
Right. Because we have this ingrained cultural obsession with the magnetic visionary leader.
The Steve Jobs type.
Exactly. The person who wins everyone over with pure charm and personality. But the diary argues that, well, charm simply does not scale.
It doesn't.
When you are leading an organization, having a clear vision that is consistently communicated is infinitely more important than just being liked.
Because when the charismatic leader leaves the room,
the magic spell breaks, everything falls apart.
But wait, let me push back on that a little bit.
Sure.
If you completely strip away the charismatic leader, doesn't that just leave you with this cold, bureaucratic, soulless machine?
I see what you're saying.
I mean, people don't want to work for a spreadsheet. They want to be inspired, right?
Yeah.
If you abandon the personal touch, aren't you just creating a factory?
It is a totally fair pushback. But I think we have to look at what actually sustains an organization over a long period of time.
Okay.
Think of charismatic leadership like a sugar rush.
Oh, I like that.
Right. It gives you an immediate spike of high energy. Everyone feels amazing in the morning meeting.
They're all fired up.
But it is inevitably followed by a crash when the real tedious work actually begins.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So systemic leadership, where clarity and structure rule, is like a slow-release carbohydrate.
Slow-release carbs, okay.
It is incredibly unsexy. It won't win you a standing ovation. But it gives the team the sustainable energy they need to run a marathon.
Because it's not about you, the leader. It sounds like moving from being the star player on a sports team to being the manager.
That's a perfect analogy.
Suddenly, the wins aren't about your personal highlight reel anymore. They are about the invisible systems you build. You can't just be the fixer.
Exactly. And the author explicitly states, systems matter more than intentions.
Oh, wow.
You can have a building full of deeply well-intentioned, highly motivated people.
Which schools usually do.
Yes. But if you don't have structure, accountability, and follow-through, all those good intentions just collapse under the weight of reality.
Developing others to lead is far more sustainable than personally solving every problem.
Right. But building those slow release systems requires changing the way people work.
And people hate change.
They despise it. Which brings up a fascinating point the author makes about resistance.
Yeah, the change management part.
If you introduce a highly logical, super efficient new system, people will still fight you tooth and nail.
Every single time.
Because the diary notes that change management is entirely emotional. It's not logical at all.
We constantly make that mistake, don't we? Trying to argue people into accepting change using data.
Or efficiency metrics, yeah. Imagine you're introducing a new software platform to your team. You show them a beautiful chart proving it'll save them 3 hours a week. And they still hate it.
Why? I mean, logically, they get 3 hours of their life back?
Because the resistance has nothing to do with the math. It is about fear.
Fear of what, though?
It's a threat to their professional identity. Maybe they were the undisputed expert at the old software.
Oh, and now they feel incompetent.
Exactly. Or it's a panic about the immediate workload required to just learn the new thing.
So you have to manage the human emotion before you can ever manage the operational change.
You have to. And when people resist, it's about identity or workload, not logic.
Which perfectly sets up the biggest challenge in this diary, I think.
The behavior management.
Yeah. If leadership is about invisible systems and managing emotional resistance, how on earth do you apply that to the most chaotic part of a school environment?
Managing human behavior.
Right. And in a SEND school setting, behavior isn't just, you know, a kid passing notes in class.
No, not at all.
It can be incredibly complex. It's deeply rooted in trauma, and it can be highly volatile.
Exactly. And this is where the author's philosophy is really put to the test.
How they handle it.
The source details an approach to whole school behavior management that flat out refuses to rely on the hero teacher.
The hero teacher. We all know one of those.
Right. The one individual who has this magic bond with the kids. They can walk into a chaotic room and instantly calm it down with just a joke or a stern look.
Yeah, the person everyone runs to when there's a crisis.
Exactly.
But the diary warns against those individual heroics. Why is that a bad thing? It sounds helpful.
Because if the stability of your environment relies entirely on Sarah or John being in the building, your system is broken.
Oh, yeah.
What happens when Sarah is out sick? Or what happens when John takes a job at another school?
Absolute chaos.
Total chaos. The author argues that behavior management only works when it is relational, consistent, and universally understood across every single staff member.
So it can't just be one person's special trick.
No. In a SEND context, this means having a shared language of behavior with highly predictable routines that do not change depending on which adult is in the room.
Okay, the diary uses a specific phrase to describe how they track all this, and I want to challenge it a bit.
Go for it.
The author says their approach is data-informed, not data-driven.
Right.
But wait, if you read any business book published in the last decade, aren't we always told by business gurus to be obsessively data-driven?
We hear it constantly.
We are told to let the algorithms and the dashboards make the decisions, you know, to remove human bias. So why does this leader explicitly reject being data-driven?
It comes down to what it actually means to have data in the driver's seat.
Okay.
If a system is purely data-driven, the dashboard has no context.
Right.
It often leads to punitive, exclusionary, or knee-jerk reactions. Like, let's say a company has a metric where 3 late arrivals trigger an automatic written warning.
The system executes the penalty blindly.
Exactly. In a school, a data-driven system might say 3 behavioral infractions equals a suspension.
It's a literal conveyor belt. You cross a numerical threshold, you get punished, regardless of the circumstances.
Yes. But being data-informed changes the dynamic entirely.
How so?
You are still respecting the numbers, but you're using them to find patterns and ask questions rather than just delivering verdicts.
Can you give an example of that from the text?
Yeah, let's use a vivid example from this kind of environment. Say the data shows a student is consistently throwing furniture and acting out at 10 a.m. on Tuesdays.
Okay, specific time, specific day.
A data-driven approach suspends them after the third Tuesday.
Right.
A data-informed approach looks at the pattern and asks, what is the root cause? What is happening right before 10 a.m. on Tuesdays?
Oh, I see.
Maybe that is the one day a week they have a transition to a noisy gymnasium and the sensory overload is triggering a panic response.
So you don't punish the panic.
Exactly. You fix the transition. It brings humanity and root cause analysis back into the system.
Which is way more efficient than just playing whack-a-mole with symptoms.
Absolutely. The author explicitly warns against blaming the staff, too. The focus is on the why behind the behavior to prevent escalation.
And doing that requires staff to be trained in trauma-informed and SEND-aware practices.
They have to look past the aggressive behavior to see the dysregulated nervous system underneath.
But, I mean, to get an entire staff aligned on this, to get them to stop relying on their own individual heroics and to trust this highly nuanced system.
You need absolute trust.
Right. And according to the source, that trust is built through one primary vehicle, relentless communication.
The communication bedrock. The diary contains a standalone sentence that I think should be framed in every manager's office.
Let's hear it.
Poor communication damages culture faster than poor decisions ever will.
Wow. Poor communication damages culture faster than poor decisions ever will.
It's so good.
I really want to linger on that because it is incredibly profound.
It really is.
If you are managing a team right now, you might be terrified of making a bad call. You agonize over options, delaying a choice because you don't want to get it wrong.
We've all been there.
But this leader is saying that keeping your team in the dark while you figure it out is actually destroying the culture faster than just making a flawed decision and owning up to it.
Because silence creates a void. And in any organization, a void is instantly filled with anxiety, rumors, and paranoia.
People always assume the worst.
Always. The author outlines exactly what effective, relentless communication actually achieves. It builds psychological safety.
Right.
It prevents misinformation from taking root. It actually empowers your staff to make their own decisions because they finally understand the broader strategic goals.
It aligns the staff.
Yes. Fundamentally, transparent communication models respect. You are telling your team, I trust you enough to let you see the messy machinery of how this place is run.
And the diary has this brilliant aha moment regarding trust.
It
cleverly splits the definition depending on who you are dealing with.
This is such a great distinction.
For you as a listener, think about who you lead. The source says students trust leaders who are predictable and genuine. But adult staff trust leaders who are transparent and principled.
That distinction is the linchpin of their whole philosophy.
Let's actually picture what happens if you get this backward.
Okay.
If you treat your adult staff merely with predictability, giving them a highly regimented day, without ever explaining the why behind the corporate strategy.
They feel patronized.
Exactly. They feel like cogs in a machine.
Yeah.
On the flip side, if you apply adult radical transparency to a child in crisis, like, if you sit a dysregulated 10-year-old down and explain the complex bureaucratic funding shortages causing their favorite program to be cut.
Oh, man.
You aren't building trust. You are terrifying them.
You are giving them an adult burden they cannot carry.
Right. So it's honesty, integrity, and communication consistently, not selectively.
Students need the safety of knowing exactly what will happen next and knowing that the adult genuinely cares about them. Predictable and genuine.
Yeah.
But the adults need you to be honest about the budget, to have integrity when dealing with difficult parents, and to communicate the hard truths consistently.
Not just when it's a PR win.
Exactly. But there is a fatal flaw in relying purely on transparent communication.
Oh, what's that?
Well, you can communicate brilliantly, you can be perfectly principled, but if the environment itself is burning people out.
Ah, right. If the workload is fundamentally crushing your staff.
Yes. Then transparency just means they clearly see the boulder that is about to roll over them.
That is such a good point, which means we need to ditch the yoga mats.
Yes. Let's talk about the truth about well-being.
This diary makes a hard pivot into how leaders actually protect their staff's capacity to function. And I absolutely love the author's blunt take on staff well-being.
Me too.
They write, it is not about yoga sessions or freebies.
You can almost hear the collective sigh of relief from every employee who has ever been handed like a branded company water model.
Or a forced mindfulness seminar.
During a week of 80-hour shifts.
We have completely commodified well-being in the corporate and educational worlds. It's become a Band-Aid slapped over a gaping operational wound.
We really have. And the author aggressively grounds well-being strictly in the reality of the workplace.
So what does real well-being look like, according to the source?
According to the diary, well-being is entirely about working conditions.
Working conditions, okay.
It is not an add-on. It is the core operation. It means having manageable workload expectations. It means clear priorities to avoid what they call initiative overload.
Oh, initiative overload. I feel like everyone listening has experienced this.
Oh, definitely.
This is when leadership just keeps piling on new projects, a new tracking spreadsheet, a new reporting platform, a new weekly meeting.
Without ever taking anything away.
Exactly. The plate is already full, and management just keeps scooping more onto it while telling everyone to, you know, practice deep breathing.
Right. True well-being means feeling heard, and crucially, having leaders who actively, visibly role model boundaries.
So if the boss sends emails at 2 a.m.,
The staff will never feel safe logging off at 5 p.m., no matter how many wellness seminars you host.
That brings up a striking phrase from the text, and I'd love for you to elaborate on it.
Sure.
The author calls staff well-being a safeguarding issue.
Yes.
Now, outside of education, that might not sound like much, but in a school, safeguarding is a very heavy legalistic term.
It is.
It usually refers to the statutory duty to protect children from abuse or neglect or severe harm. Why frame staff well-being that way instead of just an HR issue?
To understand that, we have to look at the mechanics of what these professionals are actually doing all day. In SEN settings, the emotional labor required is staggering.
Right.
We touched on this earlier, but let's dive into a concept called co-regulating.
Co-regulating.
Yeah. When a student's nervous system spikes into fight or flight, maybe they are throwing things, screaming, or experiencing a total meltdown, they literally cannot calm themselves down.
They've lost control.
Completely. So the adult in the room has to physically and emotionally act as their external nervous system. The teacher has to maintain a slow heart rate, project absolute safety, absorb the verbal or physical escalation without reacting angrily.
And gently anchor that child back to reality.
Yes.
Which takes an immense toll. You are literally absorbing someone else's panic.
Yes, you are. And after that 40-minute crisis, that teacher has to wipe their face, walk into the next room, and cheerfully teach a math lesson.
The emotional tank drains incredibly fast.
It does. The author makes the profound point that if staff are burnt out because they are drowning in meaningless administrative paperwork or initiative overload, their capacity to co-regulate vanishes.
The tank is empty.
Exactly. They might snap at a student or react defensively.
And when that happens, the child's escalation gets worse. The system fails.
Precisely. When well-being is ignored as a mere add-on, the students are the ones who ultimately pay the price.
Because they lose the safe, regulated adult they desperately need.
Right. Therefore, protecting the staff's working conditions is quite literally protecting the students. It is a fundamental leadership responsibility.
A true safeguarding issue.
Not an HR perk.
Wow. Okay, so let's look at the arc of this leader's journey. You build the systems. You communicate transparently.
You protect your staff's well-being.
Right, and you drive incredible impact. The logical conclusion is long-term success and job security.
That's the narrative we are sold.
Wrong.
Yeah, the diary's final lesson is a devastating twist.
I want to share the climax of the source's story. The author did exactly what we just described. As the assistant head teacher, they led a highly successful school-wide vision.
They did everything right.
They didn't just write a mission statement. They built the invisible architecture. They achieved a consistent pedagogical approach. They linked complex SEND needs directly to classroom practice.
And they embedded coaching-led CPD.
Which is huge.
For those outside education, continuous professional development is usually just sticking everyone in a hot auditorium to listen to a guest speaker for 3 hours.
That's awful.
But coaching-led means teachers are actively observing each other, looking at specific micro skills, engaging in vulnerable peer-to-peer feedback loops.
It requires an immense amount of trust.
A ton of trust.
So they pull this off, they transform the culture and their reward.
Yeah.
They were made redundant due to organizational restructuring.
It is such a sobering reality check.
They lost their job.
The author writes that the toughest part of senior leadership wasn't a single difficult decision. The toughest part was accepting the vulnerability of the position.
You can give absolutely everything to a role, do everything right, and still be let go.
Because at the highest level, strategic decisions are often financial or political. They are rarely performance-based.
The board looked at a budget spreadsheet, saw a line item that could be erased, and made the cut.
They didn't look at the cultural impact.
Navigating that kind of unmerited professional heartbreak, it requires deep emotional resilience.
It really does, but it leads the author to a vital realization. The diary states, you will outgrow some environments, and that doesn't mean you failed. It often means you led well.
I read that line 3 times when I first saw the notes. Impact isn't always rewarded with permanence.
But it is always meaningful.
Because you built systems that no longer require your daily heroics, you essentially engineered yourself out of the fixer role.
Exactly. Or the politics shifted and your integrity just no longer aligned.
It forces you to decouple your personal identity from your job title.
True leadership isn't defined by the letters on your business card. It's defined by the clarity you brought to the chaos and the invisible systems you left behind.
Which brings us full circle. We started this deep dive talking about the loneliness of that corner office.
The moment you realize the structural weight is entirely yours.
Right. But through this diary, we've seen a roadmap for surviving that isolation. You don't survive it by trying to be everyone's charming friend.
You survive it by building sustainable systems.
And through relentless, transparent communication that treats your staff like adults.
And by treating their working conditions as your ultimate moral responsibility.
And, maybe most importantly, you survive the inevitable heartbreak of leadership by accepting that they can take your title, but they cannot erase your legacy.
They cannot unteach the confidence you instilled in your team. They cannot dismantle those trauma-informed systems that are now hardwired into the school, protecting those students.
The spreadsheet might have erased the job, but it couldn't erase the work.
Beautifully put, which leaves us with a critical question to consider as we wrap up.
Let's hear it.
Think about your own role right now. Think about the ladder you are climbing, the title you hold, or the team you manage.
Okay.
If your current position vanished tomorrow due to a budget cut or a restructuring completely outside your control, what specific routines, what shared language, or what enduring confidence would permanently remain in the people you leave behind?
Wow.
Because at the end of the day, that invisible architecture is your actual resume,